Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Find our other podcasts like Movie Date by going to thetakeaway.org/podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. With large parts of the South bracing for another snowstorm, hundreds of thousands of kids and their parents are paralyzed by that weather today, home from school and from work. We're going to be checking in with folks from North Carolina, Alabama, and Georgia in just a few minutes. And for everyone else in the country whose children will be making it to school today, we'll be talking about the state of school lunches. It's a topic we've been debating in this country for a lot more than even a decade. How to make school lunches affordable and healthy. Has all of that talk worked? What's the state of your child's school lunch? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll talk more about that later in this hour. But first, we want to turn to an update on the situation in Syria and the besieged city of Homs in central Syria. Thanks to a fragile but extended truce, the UN has been helping move hundreds out of the city, but thousands of Syrians, including children and the sick and the injured, remain. The BBC's Lise Doucette is there and describes how desperate things have gotten.
Can you imagine living under those conditions where your neighborhood lies in ruin, where you come under daily bombardment, where gunfire never stops, where supplies of food and medicine are constantly dwindling, when you hear that your neighbors have only grass and olives to eat, when your school has been shut and no sense when it will ever open? They're happy to be alive when they come out of the old city.
And it's not just about getting people out. The World Food Program is also on the ground trying to get food into the city of Homs. Dina El-Kasabi is in the Syrian capital of Damascus. She works for the UN's World Food Program. Dina, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The truce I mentioned, which is very fragile, what is the state of military activity in Homs as food tries to get in and people try to get out?
At the moment, food is getting into the old city. So far today, enough food for almost 1,000 people has gotten into the old city, and evacuations of people are ongoing. Of course, it has been dangerous. In some of the early days, the convoy was targeted, and there has been the sound of gunfire in the distance. But until now, we have been able to get enough food for around 2,500 people into the old city, and over 1,000 people have been evacuated so far. It's really quite telling on how the situation was in the old city before. So we've heard reports of young children holding apples and bananas and not knowing what they are. And that's just one example of how desperate the situation has been.
As far as people coming out, there are many men of fighting age, young men over 18, some of whom have been evacuated. There are real concerns for their safety if they surrender, if they come out of blockaded areas, people who are associated with anti-government forces or at least in anti-government areas, that they might fall victim to government intelligence people or government forces. What do we know about that?
Well, the World Food Program is managing the provision of food assistance while other colleagues are coordinating the protection and overseeing the evacuation of the people. So, you know, as the UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Valerie Amos has noted, a number of men and their families are still being processed, and UN protection officers continue to monitor their safety and well-being.
Is it a matter of choice for people in Homs? If they want to stay and receive food, they may, or if they want to evacuate, they may, or is there anything, is there any compulsion involved?
Of course. People have the agency to make that choice for themselves. This ceasefire has been negotiated to give people that choice and to give people the chance to get out of a very dire and desperate situation. But there are people who are choosing to stay, and that's their right. But this operation is ongoing so that families, mothers, children, elderly people, whoever really wants to get out of a very, very difficult life can go out, and the UN is there to help them reestablish elsewhere.
The ceasefire expires tonight at midnight, is that correct?
As far as I know, yes, but the situation is being taken one day at a time, and every day it develops further. So, you know, a few days ago we were saying that the ceasefire was going to expire, and it was extended. So at this point, it remains yet to be seen what will happen.
So there are negotiations ongoing to attempt to extend that truce beyond midnight tonight so that you can continue your operations?
Well, what's happening right now as we speak is the delivery of aid and the evacuation of people. After that's completed for the day, then we'll see what will happen.
Dina, amidst this fragile truce, what has been the security situation for your personnel trying to deliver food aid? Is it safe for them? I had read that there was some attacks on convoys, at least on people coming out. What's the security situation?
Right now, the security situation is stable, but of course, in a conflict zone like Old Homs, it's precarious. So there has been attacks on the convoy. Right now, it's okay, but you know, we remain on standby, waiting to see how it will develop. And you know, it's a responsibility for aid agencies to make sure that the people we are assisting are also safe, as well as the people who are delivering that aid. So there are personnel of the World Food Program, other UN agencies, and volunteers of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent there to help civilians. And it's of vital importance to make sure that everybody is safe when this is ongoing.
Dina El-Kassaby is Public Information Officer with the UN's World Food Program, succeeding in getting food into Homs in central Syria, where a fragile truce has been in effect for the last couple days. Dina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now to the south, where the winter has hit the region particularly hard this year. North Carolina has declared a state of emergency. Kearns Little is the co-owner of Little Hardware in Charlotte, North Carolina. Kearns, how are things going down there?
I'm good today. How are you?
I'm all right. Kearns, how much salt are you moving down there at Little Hardware?
A very, very gracious amount today. We had several truckloads went out yesterday, and that is a mix between salt and urea, which is a different ice melting product. And a truck typically is around 880 bags, and we've had, like I said, two or three go out and deliveries to some of the airport and all the local landscapers who are in charge of de-icing the front stoops of the banks and the supermarkets, et cetera, are just loading up.
Yeah, salt bags in the thousands then. You know, Charlotte, North Carolina is in the south, let's face it, a place that's not used to a lot of harsh winter weather. It makes me wonder if your place is just not getting overrun by panicked people who don't know what to do.
Sometimes, yes. A lot of times we do have it frequently enough to, I think they know what to do, but infrequently enough to make it a large event. I'm sure just like us, the other retailers, especially grocery stores, you know, the old adage, they sell all their eggs and milks and breads and stuff. And we've sold upwards of 600-700 snow shovels yesterday. Sleds, we sold 400 or 500 sleds. Everything we get a hold of is gone. Now, we can even start selling like mortar boxes and things like that for people to sled on. It's a rare event, so these people get all this stuff, and then they'll put it in their garage for a couple of years, and then a nice event like this will happen again. So it's a pretty fun and unique experience.
Grocery stores crowded with people. Around my way, people stock up on toilet paper for some reason and water usually.
Yes, we haven't seen that. Now, we did have tons of heaters go out yesterday to the point where we don't have any but a few ceramic heaters and some forced air propane heaters, but your kerosene heaters and other things that don't require electricity went out.
Kearns Little, do you have the sense, though, that people are taking it in stride, maybe having a bit of fun with the preparations? You mentioned sleds and stuff like that, or is there a sense of dread here?
I don't think there's a sense of dread. I think everybody's going to have fun with it. The schools are out today. My children are out today, and I know Charlotte's out today. So everybody's taking advantage of the weather that's coming, trying to get ready. But let's face it, come Thursday, Friday, it's going to be well on the way to being melted.
Big cold and big snow spreading across the south. It's bad for the roads, but hey, it's good for business for Kearns Little, co-owner of Little Hardware in Charlotte. Kearns, thank you.
Hey, thanks, guys. Have a great day.
The only thing I want to experience is winning a gold medal.
Sitting on the slopes of potential history.
We hit up to 6G forces.
Where the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
If you can't race yourself, you can't race anybody else.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
We are halfway through the first week of the 2014 Winter Games, and Canada, Germany, and Norway have been battling it out for the most golds. But it's the Netherlands that's been dominating the speed skating events.
as he hits the inside. Transition will be good. And Smeekings looking to go towards gold. Has he done enough? He's way ahead. Oh, he has. 69.31.
That was the men's 500 meter, courtesy of NBC, where Dutch skaters took gold, silver, and bronze. The difference in time between the gold and the silver, just 1/100th of a second. Now, as these incredible athletes fly down the ice at speeds of over 30 miles an hour, just two blades between them and the ice, weaving back and forth, bent over at 90 degrees, eyes focused on the white ice zooming underneath them, it kind of makes you wonder, how do they do that? Eric Goff is our resident Olympics physicist and voice of our series, How Do They Do That? He's the chair of the physics department at Lynchburg College and author of Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports.
Well, speed skating is probably the one endeavor that human beings do where they self-propel themselves faster than any other way. You could use a bicycle to go faster, but you're getting help. You're getting mechanical advantages through pedaling. The actual act of skating is just you pushing back on the ice. The ice is pushing forward on you, and that is the fastest a human being can self-propel. And the speed records are in the low 30-mile-an-hour range for average speeds. We have Newton's first law that says if you're going to be moving at a certain velocity, you're going to stay that way unless a force acts on you. And if you're at rest, you're going to need a force to change that. So you think, well, if they're standing there getting ready to start, how do they get going? Well, they'll take their back leg and they'll turn it so that the skate is perpendicular to the line they're going to be moving. And they'll just shove backwards on that skate and get as much force pushed digging into the ice as they can. So the ice will propel them forward. That's the forward force on them. And then when they get going, they will keep cranking their arms and cranking their legs, trying to maintain the speed, keep the momentum going. And you get nice form-fitting suits. These things, even the technology has evolved to thermally bond these things so they don't even have seams. You'll watch the skaters. They'll have their heads down, try to reduce the air drag when they're skating. It's incredible how fast you can go while speed skating.
So forget all the physics for now. What does it really take to compete on the long track or the short track, sometimes going as fast as 35 miles per hour? Well, joining us now is Eric Flame, former speed skater and 1988 silver medalist at the Calgary Olympics. Eric, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, and we're really happy to have you in the middle of this Olympic festival with so many speed skating events going on, because I watch these things. It's my second favorite event of the entire Olympics, and I got questions, man. I'm so glad to have you here.
Okay, well, hopefully I'll have answers.
Well, we're going to talk about leg strength and push-off, obviously. We'll get to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing that always made me wonder. What about your back? I've skated a lot. I rollerblade, and every time I put my head down and go for more than 30 seconds, I just can't take it. How do you guys take the back pain?
Throughout my career, I did have to deal with some back problems and had to take a few weeks off. But basically, it's just a matter of training and strengthening, and your body adjusts. You know, we do a lot of core work on our lower back and on our abs, and you know, you just build up. You don't go out all of a sudden one day and are able to skate, you know, 50 laps on a long track in a row. It takes time, and your body adjusts.
Point being, even though those arms are swinging and the legs are moving, and we see that on TV, there's kind of a core of steel there, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, you'd be amazed to see over the course of a year what a speed skater does for training. I mean, it looks easy, and it's been fun watching the Olympics with my five-year-old, because he's like, Dad, that's easy. Dad, that's easy. And there really is a lot of, as you say, a strength in the core, back. Obviously, you know, it's all legs and butt. It's not so much arms and mm-hmm. upper body. But yeah, you need to be quick. And watching the 500 long track, as I'm sure you did, they're getting down the 100 now in 9.6, which is, you know, is as fast as they do it on the track in you know, track and field.
Yeah, and they even, I heard one of the commentators say the other night that you guys get to 100 faster than Usain Bolt gets to 100.
Yeah, right around the same, maybe a little bit. A few of the skaters can do it a little bit faster, but yeah. But then imagine too, they're still building speed, and you don't in the 500 hit that top speed till the backstretch. So you are crossing over through the corner and actually get a slingshot effect coming out. So you're really hitting that top speed on the backstretch of the 500.
Your teammate Dan Jansen in 1994 famously took a spill, went tumbling into the wall, became sort of a part of sports culture in the 1990s. And I've always wondered, despite all of the training, if you guys, when you're flying around the track and you're pumping like that, if falling, catching an edge, taking a spill is something that's in the back of your mind, or you don't think about it at all?
Correct. That's something that I've never thought about. Now, you have to remember, Dan was my teammate, and I was on the short track team in 94, watched him in Lillehammer when he finally, in his last Olympic race, the 1000, won his gold. But Dan had a lot, obviously, going through his mind in that first Olympics, losing his sister. And then there was so much, I mean, over 4 years, the pressure, the media attention, all that built and built and built. It was tough. And I think that Dan maybe just didn't, at that point when he got there, realize how much the pressure would be on him. But it's never something that you really think about. I think if you ever lose focus, even for an instant, that's what can happen.
All right, Eric Flame, before we let you go, because you've competed in both, but especially on the long track, I've always wondered if the traditional long track speed skaters who do 5,000 and 10,000 and 1,500 kind of look at the Johnny come latelys on the short track and think, ah, all they do is turn. That's Tinker Toys.
Well, yeah, I can tell you that 10,000 is not a lot of fun. 5,000, maybe close to not as much, but it's a different mindset. It is a different sport. I think that there's been more acceptance over the years of short track. And, you know, the first time it got in was 92. But since then, it's kind of the exciting, really unexpected things that can happen version of speed skating. You know, it's more of the purest traditional sport. And countries such as Holland and Norway are always going to embrace long track first. But I think that people tend to like short track.
They like the traffic jam. It's packed and anything can happen.
Exactly. Anything can happen.
Well, Eric Flame, 1988 Calgary Olympic silver medalist in the 1500 speed skating. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, we heard a little bit earlier in the program about the south of the United States paralyzed by unusually cold weather. Well, in Alaska, they're struggling to deal with the damage of unseasonably warm temperatures. In Fairbanks, Anchorage, and in large parts of the southeast of that state, they've experienced temperatures in the 40s and 50s since the start of the new year. That warm weather pattern was just recently broken when the temperatures finally began dipping below the freezing point. But that warm weather has made it hard and even dangerous in some areas for residents to get around. Michael Coffey is the statewide maintenance chief for the Alaska Department of Transportation. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Todd. Good to talk with you.
And to you. It sounds a little counterintuitive to a lot of us down here in the lower 48 that warm temperatures might be a problem and even dangerous. Can you help explain?
Well, this winter has just been absolutely crazy for us, and we do winter. I mean, that's what we're geared up for in the wintertime. Our winters, I say, unfortunately, last 6, 7, 8 months, depending where you are in the state. So everything is geared towards freezing temperature, snow. You know, we're a state of permafrost, so we rely on cold temperatures and the weather. In fact, the colder the temperatures, the better the driving conditions are a lot of times. So this year, all of January, it was unseasonably warm. Areas that should have been below zero were actually, like you had said, 40 in the 40 degrees. So a lot of people heard about the large avalanche that we had in Valdez that closed down one of our major highways for 12 days. That major huge avalanche was a result of above freezing temperatures and just it was like about a foot of rain in 24 hours. And again, that area should be snowing and should be below zero.
Do a lot of people who live in remote areas rely on freezing temperatures to drive on frozen lakes? I mean, maybe during the summer they're more isolated. So are those access points melted now?
Yeah, it's been very challenging because most of our rural communities, they rely on subsistence. And so they need to get out of, you know, out of the communities. And we use rivers and lakes as just like highways down in the lower 48. And so the, you know, delay of lakes and rivers freezing has a huge impact on the rural Alaska residents, both from they can't get fuel into villages, they can't get out and do subsistence hunting and fishing. And so, again, we rely on, we need winter here to be mobile. We're much more mobile in the wintertime when things freeze up than we are in the summertime.
I'm wondering if mud is a problem with all the warm temperatures.
Well, we have been having landslides, particularly in southeast, where, again, we shouldn't be. And these are things we normally deal with in the spring, and we, you know, not till usually April or May, and we're dealing with, you know, mudslides and that sort of thing in January, which, again, is very unusual for us.
There are large parts of the state of Alaska struggling with unseasonably warm temperatures in the 50s in some areas. Michael Coffey is the statewide maintenance chief for the Alaska Department of Transportation. He's been telling us about how melted lakes are making it harder for people to get around, mudslides and even avalanches, not due to the cold, but due to the warm weather. Michael Coffey, thank you so much. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Well, the season is here when the top dogs are separated from the underdogs with only one canine winning Best in Show. I speak, of course, of the 138th Westminster Kennel Dog Show this year. There were nearly 3,000 entrants in the annual competition, from the standard poodle named Allie, who won the non-sporting group, to a Cardigan Welsh Corgi named Coco Posh, who was the victorious herder. But in the end, the judges could crown only one champion as Best in Show. Here to tell us more about the winner, the losers, the headline makers, is Sarah Montague, a takeaway tradition, our lady at the Westminster Dog Show, resident dog expert and producer here at our partner station, WNYC. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
So good to have you. Best in Show, who won this year?
This year's winner was a wire-haired fox terrier, after all painting the sky, known as Sky.
Known as Sky. What's so special about Sky?
Sky was extraordinarily elegant and dynamic. This is what the judges are looking for on the big night.
Let's hear from one of the judges for a minute. I want to talk about this quality that wire hair fox terriers have.
She just exudes the essence, the terrier essence. And she was just on, and she showed beautifully. She just had a wonderful expression this evening, and I enjoyed her very much.
Sarah Montague, the terrier essence, what is that?
That was Best in Show judge Betty Regina Leininger talking about her pick. What she's looking for is a combination of energy and elegance. Co-owner Tori Steele said that one of the reasons she got interested in wire-haired fox terriers were those old Thin Man movies where Asta, the wire-haired fox terrier, is always making William Powell look ridiculous. So they're meant to be really eager, but they're also meant to be graceful, and that's really the quality she had.
Holding her head up in sort of a tense body and...
Exactly. Not tense, poised, like a dancer.
Let's hear from, I believe this is Gabriel, the handler is Gabriel...
Gabriel Rangel.
Let's hear from Gabriel Rangel, the handler of Sky.
Well, she didn't really make any mistakes and she was pretty good. We're kind of saving it for, see if we can get to the end a little bit in high status, so...
She's got a great way of kind of dropping her head where she looks as if she's thinking about it.
Yeah,
all.
She shows off her balance. You know, she's so pretty.
Sky won the Terrier Group, of course, but what's the extra added boost that it lets a dog like this win Best in Show over all the other breeds?
That was really interesting because what Gabriel was saying, though, was that he was holding something in reserve. Mm. He wanted her to have that extra something. These dogs come into the show with enormous numbers of points. They're all leading champions. The judge is not supposed to take that into account at all. She is looking for best dog on the day, and it's the dog that just seems to give everything.
What were some of the other standouts, though? Sky was best in show. There are lots of other categories.
Yes, there are actually, at this level of judging, there are now seven champions from the seven different groups being looked at. One of the other strong contenders was a Portuguese water dog called Matisse. This, of course, is the breed owned by the presidential family. And the crowd favorite last night was unquestionably the bloodhound Nathan, who, interestingly enough, also has a man-tracking title.
What is a man-tracking title?
Bloodhounds have such strong scenting ability that they are actually used often to find missing persons. Particularly in Virginia, where their work can be admissible in court.
Oh, so he has this on his resume. But the resume doesn't count
on
the day, right?
It's not like carrying over your college credits. The judge only looks at that moment and is making a choice based on that moment in time only.
Right, so credentials aside, even though he has an impressive job, he still has to show up. the bloodhound has to show up on the day and do his best.
Exactly.
Yeah. Sarah Montague, I was led to understand there was an unusual amount of enthusiasm at the show this year, but what happened?
Well, there was some downtime. The show was being televised live at the USA Network, and they were clearly running a little fast. So suddenly everything sort of stopped. This is a New York crowd. They weren't having any of this. They all stood up and started doing the wave.
Doing the wave at the dog show.
Doing the wave at the dog show.
Were you misled to thinking you might have been at a Rangers game or something?
Exactly. The thing about the Garden is that's its other life. You know, ice hockey, rock concerts, and there really is a bit of that in dog shows. Some of these top dogs have a fan base that Justin Bieber would envy.
They're doing the wave down at Madison Square Garden at the 138th Westminster Kennel Club dog show. Our woman at the dog show, a takeaway tradition, as I said, Sarah Montague. She's our resident dog expert and producer here at our partner station, WNYC, leaving the studio doing the wave herself. Sarah, thank you.
And thank you.
Dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs.
Welcome back to the show. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry. Well, it looks like the sugar industries may not be quite as sweet as you think. A dirty war between corn refiners and sugar manufacturers is now being made public by hundreds of internal documents brought to light as part of a federal lawsuit filed back in 2011. Internal emails and strategy documents revealed that both the corn and the sugar industries funded nonprofits. They funded academic researchers and public relations firms in order to bolster the public image of their products while stoking fears about the health risk of the other guy. And they did a lot of it in secret. Joining us now to explain is Eric Lipton, enterprise reporter for The New York Times, who covers lobbying and corporate agendas and reported on the story in The Times. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you doing?
Well, thank you. You know, Eric, we've been hearing a lot of stories in the last couple of years about corporations influencing politics anonymously, like Citizens United. But you're writing about a different kind of anonymous influence that seems a lot more insidious in the sugar industry. What's happening?
Yeah, there's a lot of surrogates that are at work in Washington that aren't necessarily registered lobbyists, but that work in equally effective ways to try to influence public opinion and also members of Congress. And in this case, was a story looking at how the big sweetener industries, the corn industry that does high fructose corn syrup, and the sugar industry that put, you know, what you have in your sodas, that both of them essentially gave money to nonprofit groups to try to echo their message, trying to grab market share and hurt their competitors.
And this was a case of one side trying to get their sweeteners deemed natural, kind of sweeten up the language, if you will, the other side trying to stop that, and then trying to fund science to make the other guy look bad, essentially.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the sugar industry, dating all the way back to about 2004, decided that it wanted to try to take away some of the high fructose corn syrup business because that was what was widely used in a lot of sodas and even snacks. And it thought that if it could fund research that showed that high fructose corn syrup was perhaps contributing to obesity or diabetes or other health issues in a way that was different from sugar, that they could get companies to stop using it and switch back to sugar. And it turns out that there were, in fact, a number of studies that were published that made that point. And then the sugar industry, using its nonprofits, you know, highlighted those studies. And ultimately, some of the major consumer products moved away from high fructose corn syrup to sugar.
And how did the corn industry respond?
So the corn industry mobilized itself, and it began an even more elaborate and expensive campaign. It funded researchers who it not only paid to do the research, but also put them on retainer to contact any newspapers or academics who suggested that high fructose corn syrup was less safe than sugar. It then also hired its own nonprofit group run through a public relations firm in Washington that then ran ads. And even though it said that it wasn't supporting that effort, it in fact was. And they both created as much noise as possible as they used sort of a covert approach to influence public opinion and also to try to influence the FDA. The sugar industry tried to block the effort by the corn industry to get its high fructose corn syrup renamed simply as corn sweetener. And ultimately, the FDA rejected that in part after a loud protest from a group called Citizens for Health, which had secretly been funded by the sugar industry.
Right. Citizens for Health sounds like a bunch of school moms who are concerned about health. In fact, it was a front group for a multi-billion dollar industry. And there's a lot of that in your story, Eric Lipton. You mentioned the word covert, and I just wanted to point to one part of your story that you touched on briefly, where the corn industry hired a PR firm to place ads promoting their product, but they didn't want to be associated with the front group that they had set up. So they kind of secretly spirited the money to the PR firm, but not the front group, and had plausible deniability. Is it as simple as that? It seems really dirty what they did.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they were trying to keep confidential their support for this nonprofit group, which was set up through a for-profit PR company. And so their way to do it was just say, we're not helping the nonprofit group. Both sides were not doing full disclosure on their work. And I guess it gets back to sort of what is extremely popular in Washington and becoming more popular, which is working through surrogates. You know, I just had a lobbyist I went out to lunch with last week who was saying to me, this is so frustrating. I'm the one that has to register and disclose. I'm the one that always gets beat up because I'm the corporate lobbyist. But in fact, it's the think tanks, it's the nonprofit groups. I mean, they're all sort of extensions of the corporate lobbying campaigns, but they don't have to disclose.
So that's Washington. But what about scientists? I mean, you also talk about the influence on science, and we're used to hearing about, you know, scientists accepting money and doing research for products, and that's not uncommon. But what are the scientists telling you about the way they were influenced or not?
Well, in this case, I mean, the thing that this to me distinguished the situation involving the corn industry was that they not only were paying to support research, but they actually put the medical researcher on retainer. Although he still maintained his independence, essentially running his own lab, and he was not an employee of the corn industry, but he was being paid $41,000 a month as a retainer, not just for medical research. And so, I mean, that sort of changed the relationship. And even though he was then, the industry used him as their sort of academic, you know, expert to dispute any suggestion that high fructose corn syrup had any different health consequences than sugar. So, you know, the companies pick who they fund very carefully, and they know essentially what they're going to say, and then they use those statements to help buttress their lobbying argument.
Well, Eric Lipton from the New York Times, you know, consumers confront the choice of soda A or soda B or snack A or snack B when they're down at the grocery store. And you read the story and you wonder how much of what we think we know about which sweetener is better or worse for you is actually meaningful at all in a scientific way. What can a person shopping for a sweet snack think at this point about which is better for them, or at least less worse?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because so many experts come from a funded point of view, and they often don't disclose where they're coming from. You have to sort of try to make sure that whatever you're reading, you sort of look to see who funded it.
Eric Lipton, you know what doesn't have a lot of high fructose corn syrup or sugar in it?
What's that?
Yeah, a bowl of carrots. How about that?
Yep, you would be safe with that.
Eric Lipton, enterprise reporter for our partner, the New York Times, reporting on the covert war between the corn industry, high fructose corn syrup, and sugar refiners in Washington and in labs across America. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, all across America, millions, tens of millions of kids are going to be getting their lunch today at school, maybe not in the South where school's canceled, but everywhere else they will be. And we've been talking to you about what can be done to improve what your kids eat at school.
This is Tasha from Green Acres, Florida. I'm lucky that my husband and I are able to make lunch for my son and not rely on daycare. His meals are usually about $4 to $6 a day, and they are organic. But even so, there's not much of a selection, and there also aren't too many things that are healthy foods, which is something my son actually enjoys.
Thanks to Tasha. And from Grand Prairie, Texas.
I believe that public schools today are serving what amounts to fast food in the cafeterias. When my son comes home and says that he's eaten pizza today, it's difficult and challenging to make sure that I balance that out in the evening to make sure that my son isn't one of the statistics that's overweight.
Well, here's a more encouraging picture from one listener to the program on KOSU in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. I live in a small farming and ranching town in northwest of Oklahoma City. I have no concerns about my child's lunch program. Very well funded and managed. We are fortunate to have what we have compared to a big city school lunch program. Well, last year, more than 5 billion school lunches were served to more than 30 million students across the country. That's according to the USDA. In total, more than 224 billion lunches have been served since the start of that program. But with every lunch, there's some new criticism. Well, here in New York City, one problem is just how early lunch gets served. Because of overcrowding and a shortage of space, tens of thousands of kids eat their lunch before 11 a.m., sometimes, in fact, as early as 9 a.m. Meanwhile, in Minnesota, almost 4 dozen public school districts are coming under fire for completely denying lunch to students from low-income families who don't come up with the 40-cent cost of a reduced-price lunch. Similar practices have been reported in Utah and Texas schools. Well, we've been talking about how to fix school lunches for a long time in this country, so today we want to try to tackle the question and understand why is this problem so very hard to fix, and what should the school lunch of the future look like? Well, here to help me with that discussion is Marion Nessel. She's professor of nutrition and food studies and public health at New York University. She also runs the blog foodpolitics.com. Marion, hello.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you, professor. We're glad to have you. There was a law enacted just a couple of years ago. It made some news, but I covered it. It was called the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, and it was supposed to promote fruits and vegetables in school lunches. Is also supposed to have quite a bit of monitoring so the schools would tell the government that they're creating healthier lunches. Is it working?
Well, the USDA says that it is working. They did a survey and they said that something like 85% of schools were complying with the new rules and were not having very much trouble with it. And that doesn't surprise me, because if there were schools that were eager to serve healthier food, this law gave them an excuse to do it.
With money?
And a little bit more money.
A little bit more.
A little bit more money. 6 cents per meal.
Okay. Well, do we have any good indication that 6 cents per meal, or the USDA saying it's working, means kids are eating more fruits and vegetables at school? We had the one caller who we listened to who said his son comes home and says, I've been eating pizza.
Well, it depends completely on what the school is. In my experience, going around and visiting schools, the school lunch is completely person dependent. If the school has a school food service director, a principal, and some parents and teachers who are interested in feeding kids healthfully, miracles are performed. And I've been to schools in some of the poorest neighborhoods in America and seen school lunches that were quite edible, that smelled good when you walked into the cafeteria, and that the kids were eating with no trouble at all. But that depends on who the principal is and who the school food service director is. I've also been in schools where the kids didn't eat the food, where they were eating candy bars, where they were paying no attention to it, and where nobody in the school seemed to care. And when I go into a school and see that the kids aren't eating the lunch and the food isn't very good, I ask, where are the adults?
What you're describing is really a patchwork, a mosaic, and the kind of thing that these federal standards, I guess, we're supposed to help prevent. But in this country, we famously, notoriously, however you want to put it, keep Washington out of the business of local schools. And I wonder if that's part of it.
Well, that's certainly part of it. And the government has other things to do besides going to every single school in America. And there are hundreds of thousands of them. I think. There are a lot of them anyway.
Yeah.
The government can't do that. And so it relies on local schools to do what they can do. And some local school districts are performing miracles and some are not.
What's an example of some school districts where these miracles are happening, where it's really working? What are they doing?
Well, I think it's working in New York City. And as I said, I've been to some of the poorest schools in New York City and seen a school food service director and the cooks who are thinking about how they can make the food taste good.
What kind of food?
Well, it's the same food that everybody else gets in every school in America. The difference is how it's cooked and how it's presented. Now, some schools don't have kitchens, and that's an enormous problem. The schools that are most successful in producing decent lunches are the ones where the food is actually cooked.
On-site.
On-site.
And so in many schools, it's brought in, packaged from an off-site kitchen.
Or a school food management company provides the food, and some do that do a better job of it than others. But because of the financial issues, it's much, much more financially viable for a school to do its own cooking on site and buying ingredients from scratch than it is to buy pre-prepared foods or foods that are cooked by somebody else.
I'm surprised to hear you say, Marion Nessel, that it's the same food as everywhere else, but it's a question of how it's prepared. Is that really the case? I mean, all schools are serving essentially kids like pizza, so you can give them a healthier pizza choice. Is that an example?
Yes, you can do that. And of course, some schools are trying to source locally and source organic and do some other kinds of things like that. But even with the standard school menus that many, many schools use, you can make those foods taste good if you pay attention to it.
Well, what's the answer? We promised to look at the future a little bit at the end here. And if there is this patchwork and some schools are really, really doing it right, even some schools that aren't in New York City or places that get a lot of attention, what is the answer to get more of the schools that aren't using the better ingredients or better preparation to start doing it?
Well, you do exactly what you're doing now. You pass a law that requires better food, more nutritionally better food. And you do it school by school. You just go school by school by school and work through it. It's a long, slow process. It's actually going rather well by USDA standards. You hear about the schools where, that have the most problems. And, you know, kids always are going to complain about school food.
Sure.
But the real issue across the board is that we don't have universal school meals. And that's what we really need in this country. It would solve a lot of problems.
Universal school meals is an issue that we're going to cover on a future show, I'm sure, because we have been paying a lot of attention to this issue of school lunches. Marion Nessel is professor of nutrition and food studies and public health at New York University. Marion, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
So there you have it. It's not an easy problem, but there are a lot of ideas. Do you have any ideas about school lunches? Let us know at 8778MyTake. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And you can head to thetakeaway.org for detailed data about what time New York City school students are eating their lunch, sometimes as early as 9 a.m. This comes to us from Boston, Massachusetts. I always worry about what schools think is adequate nutrition to feed children. I have heard enough complaints about school lunches to instead send the kids with homemade lunches. If you missed anything or want to listen again, check us out at thetakeaway.org. You can always reach us, of course, at 8778MyTake. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.